Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening, happy Shabbat. Welcome to Yada Yah Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We have James and Kirk here. Hi, guys.
Good evening.
Happy Yamas.
We did something earlier today where we jumped ahead in time to something I had translated just a few days ago. And we did it in the observations program thinking that we would just return to where we are now in Yashaya 5, in the 14th chapter of observations for our time. And as we were talking before the show, the consensus was perhaps we should go over the same ground we went over this afternoon. I hope to provide a little different take on it as we go through it. But to my mind, what we discovered in the sixth chapter of Yashaya is one of the most gripping, one of the most revealing, and one of the most gut-wrenching presentations I've thus far encountered in 15 years of doing this. Kirk, you said that when you read it, I made a summary note, just a concluding note, which was that based on what I was reading, I came to the conclusion that had God not made the promises to Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob to take care of his descendants, there was no way he'd be coming back.
No. And that is so foreign to most people, and even to me, I hadn't really thought. I mean, I kind of understood it, but I never thought about it. I said, "My God, you know, that's really true. He didn't have to. This is not a."
Yeah. He was not just coming back if he hadn't made the promise. Yeah. I mean, I'm absolutely certain of it based upon what I read. And JB, you had the chance to go through it to edit it a bit. And so you're aware of what's there. So I'm going to begin at the beginning of chapter 6, and we're going to sneak back up on it. But for those of you listening here, you're going to hear something that should profoundly change, enhance maybe, your perspective on God. I mean, this is something that's extraordinary. It begins by discussing that the powerful man in Yehuda that Yashaya knew had died. And he died alone. He died with leprosy because, like most dictators, he was presumptuous. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw my upright one establishing a dwelling place before his seat of honor, as he was engaged raising and lifting up. The train of his magnificent flowing garment filled the enduring, enabling, and empowering resonance. Kirk, we talked a little bit about this, and I don't want to avoid or minimize the power of words and not share some of the insights that come along with this. One of them was, I don't care how rich you are, I don't care how powerful you are, if you're not with Yahweh, if you're not reliant on Him, you're going to die. Uzziah died.
Yep.
The second is that Yahweh was establishing a dwelling place. Like any father, he is committed to making a spectacular, wonderful, safe, enjoyable, educational, nurturing, loving home for his children. He was engaged doing the one thing that he wants to do the most, establishing a dwelling place. Now, his dwelling place was before his seat of honor. What is his seat of honor? JB, do you know what a seat of honor is?
That would be
most
the
people would go right to God's throne. Now, God's not seated. God's not tired. He does not need to sit down. There's no gravity where we're going. Yeah. So his seat of honor has nothing to do with his throne, which is how it's rendered in almost all English Bibles. What do you think the seat of honor is?
The Ark of the Covenant.
You betcha.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, the Ark of the Covenant, most people just think it's a chest with a couple of poles and it was carried along. The design of the Ark of the Covenant is a seat. And it has a back to it, as all good seats would have, and the back of this one happens to be golden wings, which are our wings. And the seat is the mercy seat where the blood of the Passover lamb was sprinkled. Yosha's blood was sprinkled on it because of its location. It is the seat that empowers us, and enriches us, perfects us, makes us immortal. And that is the reason we can sit beside God. And again, no gravity where we're going. It's not a seat in the sense of, boy, we're going to really need to sit down.
Yes, sir.
It's a position of honor. Position of honor is that we are God's children. Doesn't get better than that. And he was engaged raising and lifting up. That's what he does. He raises his children and he lifts them up. Then it says, the train of his majestic flowing garment filled the enduring, enabling, and empowering resonance. The way God causes us to endure, enables us, empowers us, is through his garment of light. And we are adorned in his light. This is what Yahshua saw. But it's amazing, and we made this point earlier today, Kirk, that we have a tremendous privilege of being able to research what Yahweh said to his prophets and to convey it as completely and as accurately as possible and to do the best we can to help everyone understand it. Mm-hmm. But Yahshua, that's an entirely different league.
It was right to the source.
Yeah, he's not just having God talk to him and providing this information through him. He was just invited into the seventh dimension. He was invited into heaven.
That's
pretty extraordinary.
Yeah,
absolutely. Now, he says the next thing that happened is that seraphim approached from above him, having six bleached white wings, each one with two covering its presence, some say face. With two, they concealed their feet, and with two, they flew. I suspect that the reason that they're covering themselves is to not draw attention to themselves. They're there as tools, as implements to serve. They're not there to draw attention to themselves, and they would be spectacular. And, you know, could get into the Hasatan thing of, ain't I beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's part of it. And I think part of it is that you know, they're not physical mortal beings And so what Yashigai is seeing is that which he could convey symbolically in words. And the idea was that they could fly. They had wings. And what kind of wings, by the way, are there in the back of the mercy seat? When he's talking about the design of the wings, aren't they seraphim?
Yeah.
That's correct.
They are indeed. So he recognized those wings because they were the same wings that were in the back of the mercy seat. Then they called out to one another. The Masoretic says that one said to another, but the Great Isaiah Scroll says they called out to one another. The Masoretic says, set apart, set apart, set apart. The Great Isaiah Scroll says, just set apart, set apart. Which is really as far as you can be set apart. You can be set apart unto Yahweh or from Yahweh, and you can be set apart from matter to spirit or from spirit to matter. So you can't get a third set apart. There's only two. And it was set apart, set apart. It has been my conclusion since very early on in this process, probably 15 years ago, that the concept of set apart is more essential to understanding who God is, what he wants, where he is, how we engage in a relationship with him, what his view is on the institutions of man, and the nature of the Spirit and of the Son. That there probably is no term more central to empowering that understanding than the concept of Kadash or Kadosh, set apart. And yet, it's the concept that is completely destroyed in religion by being replaced with holy. If the Spirit's the Holy Spirit, you have no idea what, in fact, you don't even know it's that she is a she.
Mm-hmm.
And you have no idea that what her relationship is with Yahweh, and so you come up with this ridiculous notion of a Trinity, where if you understood set apart, you can have a diminished corporeal manifestation and a set apart spiritual manifestation of Yahweh, and still have just one God and one persona, one individual, with two aspects of his nature set apart from him. Now, one of the things that was really interesting as I went through Yashayah 7, have you guys ever confronted the debate between, was the prediction and the prophecy in Yashayah 7 that a virgin would conceive a child or that a young woman would conceive a child?
Well, I know you can use both. You can use either or on your translation.
I thought so, too, but that's not the case.
No?
No, I thought so, too. Yeah, the word that is used means young woman. It's the female. It has the H at the end to take young man to young woman. There is absolutely no association with virginity. It's just a young woman. So it's a young woman's going to have a child, and it's going to be a son. Now, the one place where the Masoretic is corrected, the Masoretic says, and she shall call his name Emmanuel. That's not what the, and that would be wrong, by the way, because there's no evidence whatsoever that Mary ever called him Emmanuel. The Dead Sea Scrolls, the Great Isaiah Scrolls, it says that, and his name shall exist as Haya versus Kara, and his name shall exist as Emmanuel, God with us. Well, that's true.
That's
the other part would have been false, but there really isn't much of a prophecy in that regard. And one of the things that's really interesting, too, is, in my view, and we'll talk about this in future programs, I don't think it matters if he was virgin-born or not. Doesn't matter to me at all. I genuinely do not care. I don't think it matters one iota, and I think there's a specific reason that God did not mention a virgin birth. What do you think that might be? Bethula is the Hebrew word for virgin, and he didn't use it. Why don't you think he used it? You guys got any idea?
No. I would have, my only guess would be something related to the fact that so many pagan religions use the virgin birth concept.
Who is the goddess that Yahweh went out of his way to denounce by name?
Asherah.
Astarte. Astarte.
Same thing.
Astarte. So, he uses the word Astarte. Easter. He specifically calls her the Queen of Heaven, right?
Yeah.
Well, Astarte is the Mother of God, the Virgin and Child, and the Queen of Heaven. So if Yahweh mentioned a virgin birth, he is playing directly into the hand of the world's leading religions, and particularly Roman Catholicism, where the Blessed Virgin is the central part of the foundation of the religion. So you're right, James. He didn't use the word for virgin, because even if he was born of a virgin, it would have played into and justified a religious myth. And I think it was Roy that was in, it's not Roy, and if I have it wrong, I apologize, but was the first to say that, and I thought this when I was beginning to translate Yahshua 9, that Yahshua was born as an essentially an ordinary kid. The only thing that was different about Yahshua versus any other kid is that he had Yahweh's nefesh. But other than having Yahweh's nefesh, his Yahweh's soul, it did not matter who his physical father was, because his physical body was there to serve as a Passover lamb, and the Passover lamb's role at Passover is purely symbolic, even though the lamb is in fact the body of the lamb is killed. It's wholly symbolic. So his body is just a symbol of the Pesach lamb. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So long as he has Yahweh's soul. And what I think Roy was the one that came up with the realization that he became the Son when in the Jordan River. When right. So I think there's. Well, listen, I don't know for certain. I'm speculating here, but I think there is considerable reason to form that conclusion. And one of the things that's really interesting is that in Yahshua 7, one of the next comments is that it says long before he will know the difference between right and wrong. The northern kingdom, Ephraim, is going to be severed and destroyed. Well, if Yahshua was an eternal being and came into existence at the same time of the universe, that wouldn't be possible. It wouldn't be possible for him not to have a fundamental understanding of the most fundamental thing, the difference between right and wrong, good and bad, good and evil. And for him not to have that understanding prior to 700 BCE is unfathomable if he always existed. You know, that's the Christianity view that, you know, he is...
Foundations of the world. Sort of
Right. Always there. I don't think that's the case. I don't think there's any reason for Yahweh to set apart a diminished corporeal manifestation of himself until there's a reason for him to present himself as a corporeal manifestation.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I think that's also interesting that it's destroying a lot of the myths of Christianity through this process. But set apart. Set apart tells you that Yahweh is set apart from the things that are popular among men, which would be religion, politics, government, militarism, all that sort of thing. That he is set apart from those. He's not inclusive. He's set apart. It tells you that rather than being the God who you should thank for your meal, and that you should thank for success at some point in your life, he's set apart from that sort of thing. That's not his area. It also means that all the things that are important to Yahweh are set apart. The mikre are set apart, the invitation to meet with God. The Bereth, covenant, family, set apart. The spirit is actually named set apart spirit. Yahshua is described as Kodesh, the most set apart, which it means twice set apart, set apart from Yahweh, as spirit, and then set apart from spirit to matter.
As matter.
Yeah, set apart twice. So if you want to understand the nature of the set-apart spirit and of Yahusha and us, they relate to being part of Yahweh. Set-apart is the essential key that gets you there. And if you want to understand why God isn't involved in religion, why you would never find him in any inclusive human organization, like a religious organization or a political organization, it's because he is set-apart. So what is the first thing? Here is Yahshua, the most important of all the prophets. He is invited up to heaven, and the first thing he hears is, set apart, set apart. So I would have to say that from God's point of view, from Yahweh's point of view, my fixation with this concept of set apart is the key to understanding must have some validity to it.
Yeah.
It wouldn't start it that way unless...
First thing out of their mouth.
Yeah. So, you know, I've made this point a thousand times, and it is, I made the point because the more you read, the more valuable that insight becomes. I'm telling you here, that's God's point of view. You need to understand set apart. Completely prepared and exceedingly devoted is Yahweh of the spiritual implements. The entire material realm is filled, revealing a full measure of the abundance of his accomplishments and his importance, his manifestation of power, and his rewarding gifts and persona. We won't get into as much of that tonight as we did during the show earlier today. But, Kirk, the thing we covered was... For a seven-dimensional being to create a six-dimensional universe is easy. Yeah, it's a very complicated formula, and it had to be designed perfectly to be the host of life and to be interesting and for time to play out on the exact schedule that the Yahweh wanted it to. But the fact of the matter is, it was no more difficult. At least that's my perception, for Yahweh to create the physical universe than it was for Walt Disney to create the celluform world of Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. The thing I think is enormously complicated, even for Yahweh, was intelligent life. Now, that may be... an extrapolation way beyond what's reasonable today to call us intelligent, but nonetheless, creating life that can think, can observe and respond, and that God himself can have a dialogue with, that just the whole concept of creating a language like DNA that's a three-dimensional language, I view that is the extraordinarily difficult challenge. And if you look at the universe and you look at life, and you can't see that it was created, that it is the byproduct of inspiration and creativity, then I think you're blind. And so
think about it like this: using the Walt Disney analogy, it's like this. I can draw a kid can draw a small picture of people in a house. A really talented artist can draw an accurate looking picture of people in a house. But even today, the most advanced scientists are working on artificial intelligence that can even remotely replicate intelligent life.
Right.
Yeah.
Not just anyone can do that.
Correct. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. And, humanity has never been able to create life. Donald Duck... for all of the artificial world that was created for them, there's no life there.
Yeah.
They're manipulated.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just ink on
celluloid.
Yeah, celluloid. Yeah. And I also think when it says that his rewarding gifts and persona, the very fact that human nature was designed so that we're upright beings, so that we can think our way through both threats and opportunities, so that we are prone to choose a mate for life and to bond together and to build a home together and to conceive children together and to raise and nurture and love those our children is the fact that we were literally conceived to model what Yahweh sought to achieve with the universe is profoundly important. There's really no aspect of human nature in family, husband, wife, mother, father, parent, child, that is inconsistent with the covenant. So that's part of the rewarding gift and persona that's being revealed. Now, this is the line that just tore me to my core. The thresholds where the doors opened at the behest of the set-apart mother shook and swung open at the voice of the one who issued the invitation to be called out. And then the family home was filled with smoldering disappointment and enveloped in dissatisfaction. It's hard for me to read that. I've read that now 20 times.
Mm-hmm.
I almost want to break into tears when I read it. What it says here is that the doorway to heaven, which is God's home, our home, the covenant family home, is opened by the word of God. And when God spoke it open, he was despondent. Why was he despondent?
Nobody there.
No one there.
Nobody accepted the invitation.
That is correct. The God who had issued all of these invitations, who had prepared this marvelous residence for us to live in and thrive in and flourish in, and had come with this marvelous way for us to be lifted up to him, perfected, immortalized, adopted, enriched, and empowered. The God who had laid all of that out for us and then enabled all of it on our behalf and had invited us to meet with him 7 times a year. That God's word threw open the door to heaven. And when they were opened, God was in despair because no one was there. I don't know what we could read that should have a more profound effect on us than that.
Well, I'm just surprised he didn't fold tent and say, heck with you.
He essentially did. He essentially did. And what follows is, I don't want them to know me. I'm not going to them. And if it wasn't for the fact that he had made a promise to Abraham, he wouldn't have showed up on Pesach in 4,000 Yah. And he most certainly wouldn't be coming back. He is annoyed. He's disgusted. I mean, that's what we've been reading in the first 4 chapters of Yeshayah, that God intended to rear the chosen people as his children, offer them the universe. And what they did instead is became religious and threw it back in his face and said, no, we don't want any part of you. So he opened the door to heaven, and no one was there. So Yeshayah did not have the same perspective. We've said this so many times in this program, that no one has ever been in a more empowered position than we are. No one has ever been with as clearly without excuse as we are. We're in a vastly better position to understand the mindset, nature, plan, purpose of Yahweh, to understand his prophetic account, his teaching, than anyone else in human history. And that even includes Yeshayah up there in heaven. That includes Yahu Kanan getting the vision of the last days. That includes Moshe meeting with Yahweh for 70 days and inscribing the Torah. we are given an opportunity beyond what all of them had, because we have the totality of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, and these marvelous tools to translate it and understand it, and the perspective of history to validate. You're in a stunningly empowered benefit, and we understand things like relativity that make sense of creation. We're privy to what happened in the Black Sea and the Burkle Impact Crater to make to validate the account of Noah's Ark.
Yeah, and all the histories that go along with it.
And we understand, we can look up Babel and understand why Yahweh uses the term as he does, and how religion, particularly Christianity, has intermixed all of these religious myths to create this cesspool of lies.
More than any generation in human history, we have absolutely no excuse.
Correct. Or said another way, better than any generation in human history, we have every opportunity.
Yes.
We can use the tools that are available to us, including the Dead Sea Scrolls, including these lexicons, to correctly and accurately, fully translate and ponder Yahweh's testimony. Every word. And then, like this translation of Yashayah 6:4, where the thresholds, where the doors opened. You know, it says hinges, and then it talks about a threshold. You know, rendering it that way takes a perspective that you would not have had as the hearer of the word. I'm not sure that Yosha even could put it together as he was witnessing this, as he was witnessing this, the doors were opened by the word, and it was the one who issued the invitations who was opening the doors to the family home. And how that relates to the covenant, to the how the role that Pesach, Matzah, and Makudim play relative to us walking through the doorways of God's home. We have the opportunity to put all that together. And the instant it was being revealed, I would be surprised if Yashayah had the capacity to do that. But that wasn't Yashayah's role. Yashayah's role was to reveal what he saw so that we would have the opportunity to put these pieces together and understand what he was conveying. That's why he was a prophet.
Yeah. Well,
so Yashayah...
You know, that's something to point out, though. You know, contrary to how, you know, you get so many of these cults, you know, you look at, like, the Mormon Church and their view of... They're held to these, like, levels of whatever they say is divine. You know, by and large, we don't have a whole lot from Yashayah. We have what Yahweh told him to say and what Yahweh told him to write. And anything he said or did beyond that is irrelevant.
Right. Correct. Yeah, we God provides every answer that we need. And if you're willing to look deep enough, there are answers there to questions we haven't even thought to ask. And really, what he wants more than anything else is he wants to provide the answers. The answers are there. All we need to do is seek them, search them. Ask for them, and they're all there. And, but most people just don't look at it that way. Now, I'm going to tell you that that Yashayah's response to what he saw would have been the same response I would have had a few years ago. It is not the response I had now. His response is, "Oh no, woe is me. I'm not going to be able to do this job anymore." He's angry at me, disappointed at me, because I'm flawed. And that would have been my response 2, 3, 4 years ago. That's not my response now. My response now is, I'm so sad for God. I don't read this and I'm not concerned for Yashayah. I'm not concerned for me. I am concerned for you, Kirk. But I'm just kidding.
Well, that's all good.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. But I'm only concerned for God. He doesn't deserve that. He doesn't deserve to invite humankind to meet with him and party with him seven times a year and to become part of his family through his covenant and throw open the doors and have no one there. He doesn't deserve that. So now I read that and my heart just aches for him. As for us and this job that we have, which is a gargantuanly diminished role compared to Yashaya, but in today's world, it's a big job. It's a really important job in today's world. But I've stopped being concerned about us being able to continue this work, and we're going to hear that's what Yahshua's concern was, that he would not be able to continue sharing God's revelation.
Mm-hmm.
JB, I think Kirk knows the answer to this because we talked about it earlier today. Do you know the reason why I'm first to admit that I make a lot of mistakes and that I've got I can rival Dode in flaws. But why is it you think that I'm no longer concerned that we'll be able to keep this this job?
I'm trying to think.
I don't think we have any competition for it. I don't think anybody else wants it.
That's true.
I think it's the same thing. I think the door is open and nobody's there.
I was actually just thinking the same thing. This is like proof. You hear so many Christians people talking about, there's always a remnant. There's always a remnant. There's always some amount. That's what this is kind of telling us. Yahshua was there in heaven with him. So when he opened the door, there was literally no one else on the planet at that time.
Correct.
Who was part of the covenant.
Not one.
So this idea that, you're such a small group, there's got to be more than thousands, really, there's been periods in time in history where not a single person on this planet was a part of Yahweh's covenant.
Yeah. And I think that had there been three people there, rather than being despondent,
Yahweh would have been ecstatic
to see those three people. He would not have depreciated.
Had there been one.
The experience of the arrival, had there been anybody else there. That's just his nature. So I think that we've got this gig for a couple of reasons. We got the gig originally.
Who are willing.
And we maintain it because no one else is willing to do it.
I hate to use the term, but it's kind of
funny to use.
We're the coalition of the willing.
Coalition of, and not just the willing, the passionate, the exuberant.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it. And the other part is that the more I do this, the less I think of myself.
Mm-hmm.
The more I think realize two things. One is that you don't have this opportunity if you have any qualifications that would impress anyone. So the only reason you're even invited, sorry Kirk, is that you can't have qualifications like the king was dead. There are no priests, there are no clerics, there are no kings, there are no generals.
Got no qualifications.
No qualifications. He was so amazing. You can have no qualifications, which makes you reliant, which is a really good thing. And the second is, the more you do this, the more you come across the realization that God's playing in an entirely different league. He is so far superior to us that I'm excited when I figure out something maybe others haven't figured out, but it's probably 1/1 billionth of what's there. God's playing an entirely different league. The moment you think you're driving the this truck, your wreckage is absolutely
probably going to be in a ditch.
Yeah. At that point, you're delusional. All right. So he said. So I responded and said, "Whoa! Oh no! This distressful situation is because of me. For surely I am ruined and will be silenced because I'm an individual with unacceptable and unclean lips. Furthermore, I dwell in the midst of a people of unacceptable and unclean lips. Except now, I have seen, I have looked upon, I have considered with my eyes Yahweh of the heavenly messengers, the ultimate authority." So was Yosha concerned that he was going to be struck by a lightning bolt and toasted, sent to Sheol, or somehow that he himself was going to have a...
tortured and burned for eternity?
Yeah. Was he...
No.
No. No. Was he at all even concerned about his own soul?
No.
Nope.
No. Nope. He was only concerned about one thing. I've got this job right now where Yahweh speaks through me. And I really, really enjoy this job. It gives meaning to my life. It's the most wonderful job you could possibly imagine. And this is my job. And now Yahweh's looking, and because I'm here, and he realizes I'm not an acceptable spokesperson. I have unclean lips, and my diction is unacceptable. Therefore, I'm going to lose this job. He's just disappointed that I'm not very good at it. That was his response. He thought he was going to lose his job. That was all he was concerned about. And Yahweh remedied that. For all of us, we've been remedied of that. Just because when you look at the terms and conditions of the covenant and what we are asked to concede, to receive its benefits, God doesn't really expect much of us. Doesn't ask much of us.
Not at all.
No, everything.
You come to this party.
Yeah,
do these things that are good for you.
Would you like to have everything I have to offer? Gosh.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Dode had enough flaws to convince all of us that our flaws do not get in the way of our relationship with Yahweh.
Yeah, certainly.
And so we ought not be stressed out about it. And the fact that Yah ought not have been stressed out about it. But I can see how in the moment he would have looked at God's displeasure and say, wow, this is a real problem here. And it must be me.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, and in a way, you could almost view it as, you know, he kind of viewed his job as being to convince people to come back to Yahweh. You know, you would think of that as, you know, as a prophet, your job is to, you know, present Yahweh's word with the intent that these people would return. And so what he's seeing is, you know, no one has. His word is falling on deaf ears.
Yeah.
We experience.
Right. We've all suffered from that. And we've all gone through a period of saying, well, we are really failing. I suck at this. And my response has always been the same. Yosha sucked at this.
Not our job.
Yahweh sucked at it. Yahweh is a pretty effective communicator. He did some unbelievable things for his people.
Yeah.
And yet there was no one at the door.
Yeah.
Now, he's infinitely more qualified at this than we are, and there was no one at the door.
Hmm.
You know, Yosha didn't do a lot better. And if Yahweh and Yosha didn't do a lot better. I mean, look at Dode and the influence of Dode. This is only 300 years after Dode. There's nobody at the door.
Yah has literally been speaking Yahweh's word, and the door was empty.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, and that part, that would be disheartening until you realize what and this is an advantage we have. What Yahweh told Samuel, What did he tell Samuel when Samuel was all bummed?
That I was literally
saying they're not rejecting you. They're not rejecting you.
They're rejecting me.
Yeah.
Correct. They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. Yep. And that's when that door flung open. It wasn't Yahshua's fault. They weren't rejecting him. They were rejecting Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And that's a very powerful, sobering sight. Then one of the seraphim flew toward me, and in his hand was a live ember glowing on a decorative inlaid object held within a pair of tongs. It had been attained from the altar. It reached out and extended it above my mouth. It said, "Behold, this has been extended to make contact near your lips. So removed, taken away, abolished, and no longer existing are your inadequacies, mistakes, and liabilities. Therefore, your offenses against the standard, your errors and mistakes, have been reconciled, pardoned by way of a ransom, and therefore annulled and forgiven." That is what Yahshua saw. There is a 0% chance that that Yahshua was in the seventh dimension with a physical body.
Yes.
There were no tongs. It was an ember of light. So he was in a realm where physical bodies don't exist. He was dealing with a being comprised of light, where holding something that is radiant energy is not going to cause any pain, and therefore the tongs were unnecessary. He was given the opportunity to see it this way and to paint us a word picture this way so that we could ponder what is being conveyed here. I mean, this is a symbolic presentation of something really important. And what's really important here is that Yahweh's light obliterates all of our failures. It just doesn't hide them or cover them up. You know, that's the reconciliation.
Light
from,
destroys darkness.
Kefar, yeah, which means to cover over. Well, that's not what's happening here. Yeah, light obliterates darkness. It doesn't hide the darkness. It removes the darkness. That's the whole concept of being adorned in the set-apart spirit's garment of light. That's why that the Yahweh's robe, the hem of his robe, filled the room, his light. Once you're covered in light, there is no darkness. It's gone. And it's obliterated. That means beyond the fact that there's no memory of it, it literally no longer exists.
Yes. I mean, that better than covering up your sins?
Or hiding them?
I mean, or hiding them or putting them under, sweeping something under the rug as if they're just
or
everybody can see them.
What's being said here is that,
don't exist.
That all of our failures are being completely obliterated because light obliterates darkness. That's what's happening here. We are being perfected by being illuminated. And it's just a marvelous illustration of how God works. So these words that Yahshua would speak would be the words of light. Who, you know, the light is Yahweh. He would enlighten the world by conveying the words of the light. So it's another powerful symbol of what was happening here. Then I listened, and I heard the voice of my upright one asking, "Whom shall I send? And who will go walking with us, toward us, and for us?" Before I answer, read the rest of that. I made a extrapolation earlier when I said the door was thrown open, and then Yahweh lamented. He was dissatisfaction just smoldered in the room. He was disheartened. And the conclusion I came to was the only thing that would cause that is for there to be no one there. Do you think that Yahweh would ask this question of who, whom shall I send and who will go, if anybody had been there?
No.
Doesn't this statement confirm that that conclusion was right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
No one was there.
That's what he showed him. He's opening the door and saying, it's empty. What am I going to do?
Right now, he's saying, okay, then who in the world are we going to send? Who are we going to work through? There's nobody there. That's why he's asking the question. The second part of this, beyond the affirmation of the first, and I think that's the way God writes, by the way. That's the way I think he communicates. He doesn't give you the answer directly. And if you ask him a question, he will provide the answer, but very seldom directly. Now, it's not a serpentine fashion.
He wants you to think about it.
Right. Figure it out. Here's the scenario. Come to understand why I presented to you this way. Come to the answer by thinking this through. And he will always affirm the right answer. He is affirming the right answer here. The reason he was despondent is there's no one there. Now, there's two aspects of what follows here. The first is, what did Yosha do that was so essential to him being... Your daughter's cute. What did Yosha do that... empowered him to be useful. How does this sentence begin? This is
Shema. Shema.
Yeah, that's right. I listened and heard. That is the difference between someone who is qualified and someone who is not qualified. I listened and I heard. What did he hear? The voice. My upright one asking.
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
I listened and I heard. Whom shall I send and whom will go? Who will walk with us, toward us, and for us? And by the way, the verb there is halak, and it does mean to walk. But it can be computed in this particular thing. It's who can we send, who will go, who will walk with us, toward us. So I answered and proposed, look, here I am, here and now, and I'm paying attention. Send me. Boy, am I so glad that we did that whole study on henna. So glad we did that study on henna. Because he said, henna, look, here I am, right now, and I'm paying attention. Send me. All we really have to do is, are we willing to go, and are we willing to listen? If we're willing to listen and willing to go, God can work with that. It's just that there are very few. Now, what's really interesting is what God says next, and this is really the reason that we turned to this. This next statement is something that is so far beyond anything that most people can even conceive. So we're going now into not for Yahweh, but for us. This is the extreme of human understanding. We have to put on our thinking caps to understand what's going on here. I think we've been equipped for this. This is something I don't think any of us could have appreciated 5 years ago, maybe not even a year ago. This is Yahweh speaking. He said, go if you'd like. Progress, travel, walk about. If that is what you choose to do, recognizing that this is your decision, call imperative. A genuine relationship is being established between Yah and Yashayah based upon the prophet's choice and desire, not Yahweh's. Yahweh's saying, I want you to go. He's not saying, I'm commanding you to go. He's saying, If you want to go, you can go. You're not doing this for me. But if you want to go, you can go. What that tells me is, Yahweh's not saying that he wants to send somebody. He's asking if there's somebody that will go. But this is, he's just responding. He said, okay, Yahshua, yeah. This is what you want to do? You can go. But, and this is a huge but say to these people, choose to listen intently. You may want to hear and understand everything, but you will not make the necessary connections required to understand. I'll be in. You will not effectively distinguish between truth and lies, right and wrong, good and bad, leaving you incapable of comprehension, thereby remaining irrational. You may choose to look, even stare, ra'ah, ra'ah. You may actually want to see, even be observant, but you shall remain unaware and ignorant.
Boy, that's loaded. That's a loaded remark, isn't it? Wow.
What God is saying here is that a little knowledge is dangerous. More than that, he's saying, I don't want anything to do with these people. I don't want them to come to know me because I don't like them. I gave them everything they needed and invited them to my parties. I invited them into my home. I invited them into my family. And they all turned me down. I don't like them. I don't want them. I don't want them to know me. I don't want them in my family. I don't want them in my home. Look all you want. Listen all you want. You are not going to understand. You are not going to know.
It wipes out Christianity, you know.
But totally and completely.
People.
Totally and completely. Gone. Yeah, fundamental precept.
And if the God they want, he ain't saying what they want.
He ain't the God that they want, and they're not the people he wants.
No.
Now, there's another aspect of this, which says that God doesn't want any part of religious people. These people were not set apart. They were religious. They were political. They were militant. He spent 5 chapters of Yahshayah explaining to us what it was that upset him about his people. And for that reason, he didn't want anything to do with them. He doesn't like them, doesn't respect them, doesn't trust them. Now, there's another aspect of this. And that is that rabbis have done a lot of damage to Yahweh by their Talmud, by replacing his name with Hashem, by coming up with their arguments and their kosher rules, and they've done a lot of damage. But had they done that damage actually using Yahweh's name, had they done that damage actually explaining what Pesach, Matzah, and Makurim represent, had they done that damage knowing the role Yosha and the set-apart spirit play in fulfilling God's promise, had they known what God was saying in his Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and used that to give their religion credibility, they would have deceived vastly more people.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want them to do that.
No,
and when I think of the post that I read, and I think everybody knows here, I don't do social media. My only exposure to social media is that when we chose collectively to disassociate ourselves from Unpopular Truth and then from the site of the 2 other renegades that that were there and did their own thing. I did not feel comfortable coming to that decision without doing a thorough investigation personally of what was being said. You know, I had read very long letters from I don't know if it's hundreds of people, but certainly scores of people telling me what was happening there and why we needed to do this. But I spent days reading post after post after post. And what I saw is people who had listened but did not comprehend. I saw people who had stared at snippets, at posts that included parts of my translations, but they remained unaware and ignorant. They no more knew Yahweh than a man on the moon. And they were vile. And they did what Yahweh, though, was trying to avoid. They used his name and terminology in conjunction with some of the most absurd lies, discrediting him. I took that really hard. I blame myself for empowering their destructive deceit. And the difference is that, and I still feel badly about it, and I bear responsibility for it. But the difference is, I'm not capable of precluding understanding, and the only thing I know how to do is to share what I have learned. To translate the text as accurately and completely as possible, and then to help explain what we have just read so that it is relevant in our lives, so that we grow, so that we're enriched. That's all I know how to do. I'm not capable of telling somebody, I don't want you to process this, I don't want you to understand it. I'm trying to do exactly the opposite. It's Yahweh's responsibility to keep the riffraff out of heaven. It's not mine. So, we made it possible for them to besmirch Yahweh's reputation. Ultimately, creating a filter that keeps people that are not trustworthy, that are still clinging to all manner of myths and lies and promoting lies in conjunction with him, it's his job. And this is how he's going to do it. Those people may parrot his name and parrot I'm Covenant, but they don't understand what they're doing.
I was thinking about this earlier today because I've had a conversation through email with someone about this. They were asking what the quote-unquote unforgivable sin. And so I sent them the third of the 10 instructions of Cardinal Stone. But that's what those people of that group were doing.
Exactly.
What Yahweh said not to do in the third of 10,
right.
Not to lift up and support his name. That is they're doing that to a larger degree than any religion.
Correct.
Because they are actually using his name.
That's why I was so torn up.
Yeah.
That's why I came within a whisper of stopping the all audio, because I realized that you can't do what they did, which was, I concluded, what they were doing was the same. Each of those individuals, and not just the leaders, but the people that participated with them, what they were doing was the single most destructive force on the planet. Nobody was doing anything worse than them. And because I was absolutely responsible for one and mostly responsible for another, I really felt awful. And what they were doing was, in fact, using Yahweh's name in such a despicable way as to bring discredit to him, to his name, to everything he stands for. It was an awful, awful situation. And,
that was something, I loved about how you rendered this verse. And, it's one of those things, and I think actually I saw something a little different in this than what I got from your writings, but, I love the way you rendered it as, go if you'd like, and say,
Right.
And to me, that was kind of speaking up. Go and talk to him if you want. Any of us who've had family, friends, you can go and try. Just know that it ain't going to work.
Right.
But it kind of speaks to the futility of the mission we have at times.
trying to reach out to people and expose them to Yahweh's word is a very futile mission most of the time.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's telling Yashaya what we've come to understand. Yeah, go if you want. I'm not going to stop you from going. And I'm going to tell you what you ought to tell them to do. They ought to be observant. They ought to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And he told them to say, tell them those things. But I'm telling you, Yashaya, they're not going to understand. They are not going to know. They will not understand. Not going to happen. So don't be disappointed when it doesn't happen. Now, I'm not sure that Yahweh explained it to him as to why it's not going to happen. But it's in our interest that it doesn't happen. It's in Yahweh's interest. Eternity is a very long time. If somebody got in, you know, like the most recent vile post that were being anti-Semitic, directly opposed to Yahweh's name by the two rascals towards the end. Can you imagine them in heaven doing that sort of thing?
No.
And it'd ruin it for everybody.
I would not want to spend eternity around that.
I wouldn't want to spend 5 minutes around it. And so there has to be a filter to keep them out. Well, you know, Yahweh's not saying, hey, Yashaya, it's your job to determine who comes and who goes and who gets in and who's locked up. I've got this one. This is really important. I've got this one. So this is these are important realizations, is that you ought not be disappointed when people don't understand. Then he says, the judgment and attitude of these people will be, of their own accord, unresponsive and incapacitated. Their ears, they have chosen to be heavy laden and thickened. Their eyes, they have opted to smear over. Otherwise, they might come to be perceptive with their sight. With their ears, they might hear. Then, using their good judgment, they might make the necessary connections to understand. As a result, they would change in return, moving towards their restoration. God doesn't want to save them. And he could not make that any clearer. He does not want to save them. He does not want them in heaven. Now, one of the hard things here is incorporating the imperative mood, which is second person volition. And it's very challenging here to get the volitional nature of all of this in there. But it is really important to convey it, that, you know, their judgment, their attitude, this is their hearts. You know, the Christians always fixate on the heart. Well, the heart is, the best way to say this is, in English would be, take it to heart. Now, the only way you can take something to heart is that you've come to know it. You've come to experiment with it and have experience with it. You've come to understand it and have worked with it such that it is something that you incorporate into your core nature, so that when confronted with a similar set of circumstances, you know how to respond. You've been there. You know the process. You know the consequence, the result. Take it to heart. Lev means to exercise good judgment based upon what you have seen, so that your steps and your response are guided by what you have learned and come to understand. That's what's taken to heart. So the judgment and attitude, the lev, of these people will be of their own accord unresponsive and incapacitated. They're doing this to themselves. Hippel imperative. They're doing it to themselves. Their ears, their faculty of hearing, they have chosen to be heavy laden and thickened. They have begun. They've plugged up their ears. They've incapacitated their thinking. And they have smeared over their eyes. You're familiar with any place where God speaks about smearing over eyes?
Okay, I could not help but think that.
Yeah.
Isn't that the definition of Christian?
Yeah, he's first of all, the Christos, the basis of Christian, means to apply drugs. Yeah, to apply drugs. Yosha uses it in Revelation, one of the few trustworthy books early on. And he's speaking of the Laodiceans and the last of the Christians. And he says, you know, you apply these drugs to your eyes. And he's saying, you know, instead of that, you really ought to correct your vision with what I have to say. And so those who smear over their eyes, the very definition of Christianity today. So this is a really inside comment. And because they have smeared over their Christianity can't be perceptive. You could talk, I just want to make this really clear, that Yahweh recognizes that when somebody is an advocate for a religion, when they're into a religion deep, you can't reach them. Their religion blinds them. They're incapable of even processing what you're saying. And ultimately, God is concluding here, we're not going to allow them. But by the way, God is saying it's not my doing. It's their own choice that have rendered them this way. But God's actually good with it, saying, you know, the advantage of this is they will never make the necessary connections to understand. They're not going to change. They're not going to return. That's our filter. Really powerful. Then I replied, how long will this last, Yahweh? How long will this last, Yahweh? He answered, until to beneficially reveal the proper path to the relationship, when the cities are desolated, Shah, they're wasted in a state of ruin. Or you could say they're closely examined, intensely considered for a duration of time, leading to a decision regarding what is observed, or the great and blaring signal is sounded, roaring onto the scene. From within, without an inhabitant dwelling therein, as a declaration of negation, revealing that nothing lives because there is no means to be restored. And homes are without men. When the material realm is desolate, sparsely populated, clothed in ruin.
Well, if this is not the Magog War he's talking about, I don't know what would be better. I know you could say, you know, from 135 or something like that, but still.
I have a little, just a very slightly different take on this.
Mm-hmm.
When he's talking about the world is devastated, homes are without men, the world is depopulated, sparsely populated, clothed in ruin. I think this is the culmination of the Magog War, actually World War II, the Magog War, the Armageddon, as well as the impact of the asteroid Apophis, as well as the side of Carne Viejo, the volcanic island causing the tidal wave, as well as the nuclear exchange between nations. I think all of those things collectively caused the world to be hugely depopulated. And he says, it's going to be all the way to that point. Now, that's either, you know, 2029 or 2032 or 2033. I mean, that's how far out we're going here. That's what he's talking about. It's going to be a long time. Now, there are a number of ways that those verbs can be and nouns can be rendered. So I'm going to share with you what I did is I wrote each definition down. You know, because JB, we talked about the Dictionary of Biblical Languages, and how it lists mm-hmm. 1 through 4 or 5, you know, in order of the priority of a definition based upon how often the word is used. So I'm going to give the first definition of ear, and the first and combining with the first definition of sha'ar, and then the second definition of ear, and with the second definition of sha'ar, and third in definition of each, and then the fourth definition of each. And this is what we read. And he answered and said, until the point of time in the continuum of eternity, and to beneficially reveal the proper path to the relationship, when, ear, sha'ar, the cities, inhabited places, and population centers are desolated. That's one combination of the primary meanings of both. Until the cities, inhabited places, and population centers are desolated. Two, when the anguish, anxiety, anger, and terror, even great displeasure, are closely examined and intensely considered for a duration of time and leads to a decision regarding what is being observed. Three and four combined. When there is an awakening and people are roused from their slumber, as the great and blaring signal is sounded, roaring onto the scene at great speed, exposing and wasting the chaff from within. Now that's the first through fourth definition of each of those words. I'm telling you, all of those things are extraordinarily important as it relates to understanding the timing of this. First, the world's population centers are going to be desolate, lifeless. Second, there is this anguish toward God, an anger towards God, and a lot of reverence for God, fear of God, leads to terrorism. There's a great displeasure on both sides. That has to be examined and considered for a duration of time, and it's got to be resolved by being observant. And then 3-4, the people have to be awakened from their stupor. They've got to be aroused from their slumber. And Yahweh is going to provide a great and blaring signal. This is, I think, his teruah. Sounded roaring onto the scene. And even in 2029,
that's coming up next week.
Yeah, and then 2029, when he lifts up the tablets of stone, and when he has the two witnesses, blaring signal, great speed, exposing, and wasting the chaff from within. Now, the same appears to be true with the concluding statement. Not only can Haaretz be rendered the land, the earth, or the material realm, there are a variety of acceptable connotations of Sha'awa. Therefore, all of what follows could have been intended. Then the land, earth, and material realm will commence a period of close examination and careful consideration, ultimately leading to a decision regarding what is being observed, all while a great and blaring signal is sounded, and many are left desolate as it approaches at great speed, leaving the land sparsely populated and those who are astonishingly appalling clothed in ruin. And we are going to see that. It's the thing that finally awakens the remnant of Yisrael, which is going to be tiny, and Yahudah, is that there are no options left to them. It's, you know, when the entire population is at the precipice of annihilation, they're going to figure it out. It's going to take that much. So these are strong words. Now, this next line may be the most difficult of all of them. Yahweh will distance himself from mankind, and there will be a great forsakening throughout the land. Now, there are two ways to render this. Most every translation I read took a different approach than what I just shared with you. They say that Yahweh will distance mankind from himself.
No.
I have it, Yahweh will distance himself from mankind. Now, I don't care, by the way, which one you choose. Whether you choose that Yahweh is going to distance himself from mankind, or Yahweh will distance mankind from himself. Or even if you were to choose that Yahweh is going to send Adam, the descendants of Adam, away. It's Rakok Eth Ha-Adam. So you could say that, you know, as a lot of English Bibles do, that Yahweh, that the Lord, is going to send man away. That's an acceptable translation of those words. But in this context, when you're reading what's happening, an equally valid but vastly more contextually accurate and compelling rendering of the words is Yahweh will distance himself from mankind. And true, you know, whether Yahweh sends his people away from his home and from his land, or you read it as he's distanced himself from humankind, it's saying the same thing. It's just that one is so much more consistent with what we've read and far more riveting. Yahweh will distance himself from mankind, and there will be a great azab, forsakening, separation, greater neglect, rejection throughout the land. I think that what Yahweh was saying here, when there's no one at the door, says you can go out and talk to them. They're not going to understand. It isn't going to get any better. And they're not going to understand until their back's against the wall and there is no hope for them. And the world is essentially a lifeless, desolated place. And Yahweh was saying, between now and then, I'm just going to distance myself from mankind. A great forsakening. I promised I wasn't going to wipe out humankind again, and I'm not going to wipe them out again. They're going to wipe themselves out. But I'm just out of here. There's no one to talk to. No one to go out and explore with. There's no one to enlighten. I'm out of here. Ought to tell all of those people that are saying grace at before their meal that God didn't provide that food. That are thanking them for their success in one aspect of their life or another, that I'm sorry, didn't do any of that. And I know we have a good friend who has a loved one that's has some medical issues at the moment. It's not God's business to resolve those. We can come to Yahweh. We can listen to him, communicate with him, learn from him, grow with him, be with him. But we have to bridge that gap through his plan. He's out of here. He is not in the church. He's not in people's hearts. He's out of here. I've distanced myself from man. He's in the seventh dimension. And those are strong words.
Yeah, I would add to that, you know, having been in that medical, you know, position, you know, I don't think Yahweh was here healing my, you know, my broken bones, but his word was here to comfort me while I was there, and it was a huge comfort being able to sit down and examine and study his word while I was in that position. So,
I
don't think he was here and he was going to heal me and I healed any quicker because of him, but it was a little bit more of an enjoyable healing process because of him.
We talk every day. And we have a marvelous relationship, and we share lots of things every single day. We can reach out to him,
mm-hmm.
but we are reaching through the dimensions to him. And, you know, my last real serious health bout was that systemic poison ivy that I had, and I don't want to compare that to what you went through with your accident, because that was far more debilitating. But I still recognized that there is an advantage of having something like this. And that is, if we didn't know some level of obstacle and discomfort, and pain and toil, we would never be in a position to fully appreciate what God's going to offer us in eternity. You know, our limitations provide the proper appreciation for what it's going to be like without any limitations. You know, your bones were broken. Well, in eternity, you're not going to have bones.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Yeah, it's going to be great. You're just not going to have the aches and pains, and so that's an essential part of it. And yet, still remaining to bear witness in her. So God's pulling away, and yet, still remaining to bear witness in her. Attempt. Just one attempt.
Yeah.
Attempt. When is this? Of course, this is the very last day. This is 15 years from now. Attempt. So she, speaking of the land which Yahweh identifies with not only himself but his people, she will return. And when that which is associated with Ka, Allah, the sworn oaths which bind, curse, and disable, are set ablaze, when they're purged and removed, along with the likes of the large edifices marking places of worship. So the land's going to return. When? When that which is associated with Allah, the sworn oaths which bind, curse, and disable, are set ablaze. When they're purged, when they're removed, along with the likes of the large edifices marking the places of worship.
Here's some good news.
Isn't going to return while it's still blighted.
I can't wait till that.
No.
Oh, God.
You want to be around it.
Oh, I want to see. I want
if he came early, he'd have to restore it all in his presence.
Correct. Oh, I want to see Israel gleaming without any of that religious rubbish. Beneficially, then.
That's when I plan on visiting the Promised Land.
That's right.
I'm not going to go there until then.
I'm going back in the 2033. Year 6000.
You're going to watch it.
I want to watch those 5 days and then hang around for 1,000 years thereafter and enjoy it. Beneficially, then, cutting down and throwing away the established and revered monuments from within it, the offsprings of these edifices who take the stand will be set apart and cleansed. I first wondered, well, how in the world could God set apart and cleanse the people who are offspring of these religious edifices, political edifices and the like? And then I realized that's all there is. And so it's got to be people that come out of them,
mm-hmm.
who then take a stand, that are the ones being cleansed. And so, after all of these things have been cut down and they've all been removed, and then the offspring that have taken a stand, who've come out of them, will be set apart and cleansed. You know, to cleanse let's put it in a human form. If it's 2 feet thick of mud outside, you're in Houston, and you've got 3 feet of mud and sewer water outside and inside of your home. Would there be any value in washing your clothes and going back outside?
No.
Instantly they're muddy. Yahweh is not going to clean his people until such time as the muck is removed. Otherwise it does no good. He's going to remove the muck. He's going to clean his people. I'm going to drain the swamp and then clean the clothes. And the clothes here would happen to be their soul, and the swamp that is being drained is religion and politics. And their end concludes the 6th chapter of Yahshua. That was a mind blower, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, boy. Well, one thing, you know, through this whole thing, there's two things that occur to me that you've been doing, which I think is quite beneficial. Normally we go through everything, you know, like 9 and then this page and those so many pages and so forth very consistently. I think it's been extremely stimulating to jump from this to what we did last week to this week, even though you lose some consistency or some continuity. Doing it the other way, it's still, these were such big issues when you are researching and you're finding these out. I mean, it's hard for me to say, well, no, let's go back and do that. You know, we're on page 38. No, this is just not mind-boggling. It's so reassuring to me, and it's so consistent with what he said all these times. There's nothing you said, even though you have new insights, they still confirm our old understandings of what he does, how he does it, what he's against, how he hates religion, how he hates politics and military. I mean, it's been, no matter where you jump back and forth, it's all consistent. And each time we find some more just thrilling insights, I think. I mean,
it isn't in us to be selfish. Yeah. It isn't in us to be selfish and to postpone revealing a great pearl of wisdom. If Yahweh shares something with us that is profoundly important, it is in our nature as part of his family to share with the family what he has revealed.
Yes, like, don't postpone it.
I mean, wow. I mean, this drives to the heart of the number one question and frustration that I get in emails. The number one question in frustration in emails is, I have a husband, a wife, a child, a friend, a mother, a father, who are just not interested. They, you know, flatly turn it down. They accuse me of being satanic. You know, I'm not able to convince them. What should I do?
Well,
you know, what's wrong with my presentation? Yeah, I was saying, you know, if you want to talk to them, go ahead.
You'll be frustrated. Let me tell you about my invitation.
They aren't going to figure it out. They're not going to understand. No, they're just not going to understand. So long as you know that going in, go ahead. If you want to talk to them,
give it a shot.
That's a fine thing. Go ahead and do it. I'm not going to stop you. But you need to know this going in. So that's really profound. God is answering the single most important question. Yes, we should want to share. I did. I went to a guy football party. You know, my wife's last words to me says, you know, you better chill. You know, this the majority of this group is like 40 guys watching a game in the guy's basement, got a beer tap on one wall, and you know, we all bring hors d'oeuvres. And so there's 40 guys in here watching six screens. Now, last night there was one football game, but a number of baseball games. And so here we are, and you know, and my wife's saying, you know, that most of the friends here, he's told you three times, this guy that I met at a restaurant the other day is who invited me, have come from his church. And so, you know, they've got their politics, they've got their religion. You need to chill.
The flag's waving in the front yard, probably.
Yeah, man, you need to chill. Really chill here. Just go and be one of the guys and enjoy the game. Well, what do you think the odds are that I was successful at that?
Zero?
Yeah, there we go. And, you know, I may not ever get invited back, but it's in our nature. They've given an opportunity to share. But our expectation of what the person is going to do with that information is extraordinarily low. But do I feel bad about sharing? No, I feel good about it. Do I feel bad that the person's not going to be able to ever get out of Christianity? No. And this is a person that was really close in that, although they were super Christian, they had been motivated to spend all of their time studying what he called the Old Testament and reading it, and he came to the conclusion that everything you really need to know was presented in the story of the Garden of Eden. I mean, so he's getting really close. So, you know, I asked him a bunch of questions about the Garden of Eden, and that's what led to a long discussion about, you know, the myths of Christianity, and we talked for an hour and a half. You know, so do I think it's likely that it's going to resonate? No, but it's still worth doing. I felt just like Jesse. I've listened. I'm here. I'm paying attention. Send me. Okay, well, if you really want to go,
go. But you want to hit your head against the wall, go ahead.
Yeah, but yeah. Yeah, I mean, but
take
what did you mean? But, you know, and yeah, I was not saying, hey, you're stupid for going, because he did the same thing.
Yeah.
He went to.
Tell everybody.
Right. He went to. He
went shy about it.
I was doing the same thing that he would do. And, you know, the conviction of somebody that has actually been to heaven and seen Yahweh, you would think would be overwhelmingly powerful. Listen, I've been there. I've seen it. But how is that any different than ours? I mean, our conviction of knowing Yahweh is every bit as profound and resolute as was Yahshua's.
Well, I found that if you took the top 20 arguments as presented early in Question and Paul, and you share that with somebody, and nothing their eyes gloss over, then you ain't got hope.
Yeah, you notice that's why I rewrote the chapter one of that book, so that if you only read chapter one, you're cooked. Yeah, it has, here are the top 20 lies of Christianity. It goes from one after another and says, so they've lied to you about this.
Yeah, so what are you going to do about it?
What are you going to do about it?
Go back and tell your play about it.
Yeah, for example, there's no institution even remotely akin to a church. This is the basis of church, and this is the word that was actually being translated. This is what it means. So this is what's being said, and it's the antithesis of a church. Now that they lied to you about this, what are you going to do about it? You know, the Trinity. What are you going to do about it now that they've lied to you about this? That there's a Jesus Christ. Now that they've lied to you about that, what are you going to do about it? The concept of Christian. Now that that title is wrong, and you know it's wrong, what are you going to do about it? Now that you know there's no such thing as a Bible. Now that you know there's no such thing as a New Testament. Yeah,
I'm going to put you in a box, label you, and dismiss you, and then pretend I never had this conversation.
Yeah. But you have been put on. You've been put on notice that is an irrational point to be.
Yeah.
Whether you can acknowledge it or not, it's up to you.
That's what it takes. You have to be irrational to be a Christian,
or a Muslim, or a socialist secular humanist,
yeah,
or one of those Antifa protesters. You got to be irrational, ignorant, and irrational. It's the only way that you can possibly succumb to any of those things. To be a communist, you have to be ignorant and irrational all the way through. You know, to promote this myth of the universe was created of its own volition, and life was conceived in many places by natural causes, it's just ignorant and irrational.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how smart you think you are, you are ignorant and irrational. So it comes in many flavors, which is why God says, yeah, go ahead. Try to reason with them. I'm going to work. Now, they may listen to you. They aren't going to hear you.
Yeah, some people are very polite if they know you too, if they know a little bit about you. Are they, in my case, when we first started, my students really liked me, and they would listen to me and just nod and go, wow. An hour and a half later, they would just walk out going, they must have been thinking, he's lost his mind.
Yeah, good grief. Oh, my God. Yeah, he has really gone off of the deep end. Well, I'm sure that's what they think. Like this guy brought up, I was talking about my Paul, and he brought up Timothy's letter. I said, yeah, it was his love letter to Timothy. You know that Paul was a homosexual. And he says, oh, that must have been the thorn in his side. He says, no, that's not the thorn in his side. Do you ever read? He tells you what the thorn in his side is. Haven't you ever read the end of the statement? Well, no.
possessed.
Well, what does it say?
Okay.
It says it's a messenger, and a gelos, which is the translation of the Hebrew malach, which are the spiritual beings. It's a messenger of Satan. He's sane. He's demon-possessed. That's a thorn in his side. He's demon-possessed.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Dave, yeah, the conversation was, and I told him that well, the Torah prophets and Psalms are about 99% recoverable between the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the fact is only one word in 14 that differ anyway, and that 90% of those differences are usually fairly small. And that if you go back and remove the diacritical markings that came in the 11th century and just look at the meanings of the words themselves based upon the letters that was used to convey them, and you deal with the replacement of Yahweh's name with Adonai, if you do those kinds of things, you can get within 99%. And God tells you the same thing from so many different ways. That 99% is more than good enough.
Yeah.
And so that's the reality of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Is that if you look at the oldest texts and you do your homework, you remove the rabbinical diacritical markings, you can get to 99% accuracy. With the Christian New Testament, you can't even get to 5% of them. So that's the opposite of what I'm told. I'm told that the textual fidelity is perfect. I said, well, how would you like this? Between the oldest manuscripts and the basis of your English translations, there are 300,000 known variants and there's 182,000 words. How's that for accurate? So, you know, the fact is, why don't you look up the oldest 69 pre-Constantine manuscripts and compare them to what you've got? Not even remotely the same. Well, so it did not happen. Yeah, so I said, why don't you, just as an exercise, why don't you send me an email. Here's how you can send it to me. And I'll send you a 20-page analysis of the history of English Bible translations. I haven't heard from it. No, I can't process that. Tough. Yeah, I know, it's really sad. But that's what God said was going to happen.
Yeah,
somebody right here, my dad was defending Paul like that. I mean, I don't even know how you defend Paul. How do you defend Paul? I mean, that God inspired a man to contradict everything he had said.
His son, his representative, said... Yeah,
that's good.
And who was quoting directly out of the Torah.
Yeah, and he claims that he is the authorized representative of Yosha, and yet he never quotes him, never cites him accurately a single time. How in the world can you represent somebody and never quote anything they ever said?
Now, I tell you, that was in the last chapter. You've had, about 3 pages of quotes from people who had recognized Paul. How is it that many well-known, influential people came to this came to realize this, and nobody else knows this?
Yeah.
I'm not a conspiracy guy, but how did they cover that up?
You know, one of the ones that was really surprising to me, because, of course, I knew Thomas Jefferson, although I actually found the entire letter with for Thomas Jefferson. So I just...
You know, it's much more
damning. I went the entire whole thing in. Yeah, I just took the time. I'm going to type the whole letter, because the whole letter is just fascinating. But the one that I was surprised with was the Will Durant. You know, Will Durant is probably the most... comprehensive historian of our day. If many of us own Will Durant's History of Civilization, it's like 20.
He's certainly one of the most prolific
volumes. Yes, and he goes through everything from the dawn of civilization, all the way through the founding of all the European countries and through Europe. I think kind of I think he stopped somewhere around World War One. But his history of civilization, what he wrote about, you know, Greece and Rome and Babylon and Assyria and Carthage and all of these places, and Will Durant was just matter of fact. I said, you know, there is no way that this man accurately reflected Yosha. It's one of the great crimes that have been perpetrated on humanity is what he said, that people have chosen to believe him over the inspiring teachings and words of course, they all know him as Jesus. But so many of those people. But, you know, one of the things that was interesting about them is not a single one of them, well, I don't know whether 30 or 40 that we cited, not a single one of them called Paul out as a fraud, because what he said was the antithesis of what the God who he claimed inspired him had said. 100% of them called him out because
Jesus.
Right, because he, Paul, and Jesus were in irreconcilable conflict. And while that's important to know, you know, that the Sermon on the Mount and Paul's letters are the antithesis of one another. So one of the two was lying. And it can't be Yosha's lying because Paul claims he's representing him, so it means that Paul is absolutely unequivocally a liar. But when you claim that you're representing the God of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and you contradict everything he has to say, that's far more profound, and not a single person wrote that.
Well, they don't read the Torah, so they probably don't want to go there.
Correct.
Yeah. Most of them are arguing from a Christian or, you know, at least Christian-centric perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Or, you know, I think that's true. They're just arguing from a... It's just that, like, our whole world was... Whether or not you were a Christian, as Kirk and I were,
mm-hmm.
or you were just raised in a Christian culture, your viewpoint is heavily shaded by that. Paul's is easily the most influential man who's ever lived.
Well, you know, a perfect example of that is, well, I don't come from a Christian, necessarily Christian background, you know, the whole virgin birth, like we talked about earlier. I just assumed that that was in there. And, you know, the first time I went through it, I've actually had debates with people on, you know, whether or not it was a virgin birth before. And I was arguing, yeah, it was, obviously. And then, like you said, I went through this, and, you know, you're pointing out the actual evidence, and then looking at it, I go, you know what? That wasn't wrong. I was, yeah, my background and my upbringing betrayed me here.
Yeah, now, is it possible that it was a virgin birth?
Oh, yeah, it could have been.
But we don't know that. And there's no benefit for us knowing that. And clearly, all God said, and now you might wonder, why would God have such a crappy prophecy? Excuse me, but that's just a crappy prophecy. Oh, a young woman is going to get pregnant and have a child, and that child's going to be a son? Okay, that happened some 10 billion times. That's a hell of a prophecy. That's right in the range of Nostradamus. Why would God...
That was kind of my view when I would argue this with people. Was I'm like, you know, yeah, well, obviously, you know, if it's a sign and it's a prophecy, it must be something unique and, you know,
right,
out of the ordinary.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that was my view, too, by the way. And that's how I came to previously view it as a virgin. But there is a Hebrew word for virgin. It's Bethuah.
Yeah.
And that's not the word that's used. And so there has to be a reason that it's not that. And the reason was obvious. We'll get to this in a future show, but there's a fellow named Ahaz. He was the king of Yehuda, and Yahweh asked him. He offered him the opportunity to receive insights and answers on the most profound things in the universe, and as it relates to what's important to man. And Yahweh said, yeah. Ask for any of this, and he gave him examples of what he could ask for. I'll answer any question you've got right now. I'll do whatever you'd like to reinforce your knowledge and understanding. And Azaz says, no, I don't want to make any request of you. And I don't want any verification. And so it's immediately after that, said, so, okay, Yahweh says, so a young woman's going to give birth to a child. That child's going to be a boy. Okay. If you don't want to know, I'm not going to tell you.
Why bother?
Yeah. Why bother? Now, the fact that a young woman gave birth to a child does not preclude that it was a virgin birth. But it certainly doesn't.
It may be very relevant.
Yes, but it doesn't predict one. We don't know, and it does not matter. The only thing that's important is, did he get
that? My question on this would be, and you would probably know more about this than me, having studied it more, doesn't the Greek text seem to indicate that, at least in the, quote-unquote, gospel?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It does.
But that could be yet another discrepancy.
The Greek text is trying to say that it happened this way in harmony with the prophecy. But the prophecy doesn't say it. So when you see it written...
It's kind of the old thing. They threw a dart and then drew the bullseye around it.
Right. So what you've got there is something written in retrospect to say, well, it had to happen this way because this is how it was predicted, but it wasn't actually predicted that way. So now you know you're dealing with something that's not inspired, because when it speaks of it and it justifies that that's the way it happened because that's the way it was predicted, when in fact it wasn't written that way, you know you're dealing with a logical fallacy.
Yet another nail in the coffin, that is the Greek text.
Right. Correct. Another nail in the coffin of the Greek text, that it makes an assumption of the Hebrew that is not true. Now, then the Roman Catholic site, they would say, well, it's virgin in the Septuagint, and that means that they knew that was what the word, that's what they translated, so, and that's what the disciples used with the Septuagint, and it's virgin there.
All that does is
prove that the Septuagint is an inaccurate translation, but not a single Roman Catholic came to that point of view. Nor did they come to realize that the Septuagint was almost non-existent and extraordinarily unreliable, and that the oldest manuscript that we have of anything even resembling a Septuagint of anything beyond the Torah dates to 300 CE, more like 375.
Every one of the disciples spoke Hebrew. They
spoke
would have
Hebrew.
Been reading the Torah in Hebrew.
Hebrew. Correct. Correct. Not in not in Greek. Not a single one of them spoke or read Greek. And so it's just people, as Yahweh said, they can read all they want. They are not going to understand. And I wanted to respond to these people on this Roman Catholic site, and you said, no, it's not even worth the time. You cannot fix stupid. Stupid's something that's just not resolvable. That's why God said, I'm just going away. I can't deal with this anymore. I gave them the opportunity to be smart, and they've chosen to be stupid. I can't fix stupid.
In the tech world, we call that a DUA error.
What do they call it in the tech world, JP?
A DUA error.
Okay.
Dumbass user error.
I remember UL was writing code for the first computers that were installed for General Motors. And the first time they ever had a computer to manage production. And he wrote this program as a manual as to how to use the program. So he wrote the code for the first code ever for the automobile industry to manage a production. And he wrote an operating manual to tell these guys from the United Auto Workers how to input data and then get the answers they were looking for off the computer. And And after, he said, I'm going to give it to you now for 2 weeks with the manual. And then at the end of 2 weeks, we'll meet again, and you'll tell me where you're, what's working for you and what's not working for you. They met 2 weeks later. They said, well, he said, it's not working for us. Well, where are you stuck? Well, it's just not working for us. Well, what is the problem? Where do you get that you get bogged down? He didn't write in his operating manual, push the red button to turn on the computer. They didn't turn it on.
Yep, that's a DAU error.
Yeah, there you go.
Back in the day, it was ID10T, but people caught on to that, so we had to change it.
Yeah, so you had to rewrite the owner's manual. Begin by pushing the red button that says on.
On. You can't fix stupid.
You just can't fix stupid.
I'm a firm believer in that, you know, stupidity should hurt.
Oh, my wife told me the other day that they're big news in the in Rome is they found the bones of Saint Peter.
Right.
Yes, it's some obscure floor of some obscure church. Yeah, right.
Okay, let's say it was. Whoop-dee-doo.
New shrine, new money. New pilgrimage.
Oh, gosh.
That's what we learned tonight is, these people were very flawed people. Yeah, Yahshua was a prophet. He was still just a person.
Correct.
These were not perfect beings.
I have no interest in ever seeing the physical body or bones of Yahshua. You could offer me right now I have a man crush on Dode. Dode's my dude, man. I just love the guy. If you
here are the bones of Dode. Okay.
If they could be reanimated and I could see him as a flesh and blood individual as he really was, no thanks. No thanks. That wouldn't do a thing for me. And if you could would you like to meet directly with Yahshua, the Christian Jesus? No. No.
No. I'm not going to get anything from that.
No, not a thing from that. Wouldn't do a thing for me. Would you like to see what he really looked like? No. Don't care. It's irrelevant. What's it matter?
Nothing.
Nope. Nothing.
I tell the people, Jesus was black. Who cares? Does the color of his skin make any difference in anything?
Yeah. By the way, he wasn't. He was a descendant of Dode from the tribe of Yehuda. He could not have been. But it would not have mattered. There are things that do matter. He has to be a descendant of Dode, and therefore he is Yehudim flat out. And so, in his case, his race matters. But his appearance does not.
Yes.
Thank you for letting us go on this here, the sixth chapter, even though we haven't finished the fifth yet. I know it's a bit staccato, but this was pretty powerful stuff.
Great fun. It's great fun.
Yeah.
Great.
Far more.
Thank you for working so hard and traveling, both of you.
Yeah, I think it's far more intellectual, cerebral than anything we've dealt with in a long time.
Yeah.
This actually, to understand this, really requires you to put yourself in Yahweh's mindset. Put on his eyes and look at this from his eyes. To understand it.
Yeah, extraordinarily revealing of his character.
You don't
think of him in these terms very often.
It gives you a
he's that upset, or because you always think, he knew what was coming. And he was extremely upset.
sound there.
Yeah. Yeah, this,
it's like the one before you did before when he's looking at the field. And I gave what more could I have done?
What more could I have done? Yeah, what more could I have done?
That's just as tearful as I opened the doors and nobody came.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you, Steve?
What more could I have done? I opened the door and nobody came. All right.
Gosh, yeah,
I've got an old blind dog that's now trying to get outside, so I've got to deal with her.
All right,
Okay. Good night. Enjoy your new dog.
Goodbye. Shalom to both.
Yeah. Enjoy your new dog, Kirk.
And enjoy Tarua.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I want Chewbacca as the name. I'm voting for Chewbacca. Dog looks like Chewbacca.
That ain't going to happen, but we'll carefully consider it, okay?
Okay. Well, thank you.
Bye, y'all.
Talk to you guys next week. Good night. Bye.
Bye.